Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. This is episode number 117. We have two lovely sponsors. Campaign Monitor. Oh, we love them. So cool. It's one of my favorite types of web apps because it makes such a hard job so easy. It is sending email. We'll tell you more about that later in the show. And Environments for Humans, who are promoting their in-person CSS DevConf conference that's coming this October to New Orleans. And you're going to want to hear about that later in the show too. But for now, let's kick things off.
Hey there, shopping maniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast about front-end web design, development, guns. We got a car question in very recently.
I know, and then it had an MP3 link, and then it just linked to recordmp3.com instead of linking to the actual. So either the they just didn't MP3. Record one or they screwed up the thing, but I was like, oh my God, I would play that so hard.
Yeah, it was like, I'm having trouble with my... whatever, 93 Pontiac. Too bad. Ah, well.
Nissan hey. Altima.
Yeah. Oh, well. Hey, here we are. We are doing another guestless episode, Chris. Why is that?
No guests, no drama, no news. It is a rapid fire. It's our 29th one, as a matter of fact. I don't know why we number them. We just do. Why not? Numbers are fun.
Yeah, it's 117, rapid fire, 29. Can you believe that? That's a lot of rapid fires. That's like 30.
It is. We get a kick out of them, and the feedback is pretty good, too. We'll never not stop having guests. Oh, gosh, was that a double negative? We're going to continue to have guests because guests are fun, and it makes it fun for us and stuff, too. But we record these kind of just whenever we get a free second, so that way when Dave or I are traveling, we can play them. They never sit in the can too long, so don't worry about them being out of date, though. Let's do a question by Mr. John Robert Nicaud.
With this, with this trend of big background images and full width slider, which size of images do you recommend to have a balance between size and weight?
So, like, imagine a carousel that's the full width of the browser window, or maybe even is the size of the entire screen.
Like medium.com when you open a post in Medium, right?
Right.
It's like full page image.
And right? Generally, we're talking raster town here, too. You know, I mean, clearly vector SVG graphics have a good place on the web, but I tend to think of carousels as things in which that have raster graphics and news items or, you know, secretaries with
like
headphones on with
headphones,
the
yeah,
you know, just like stupid garbage.
Or like in the case of a Medium article, it's got to be a picture of a book.
Yeah,
you know, so you know you're serious.
Or like the Jen Schiffer model of like blurry copyrighted stuff from a stock photography.
Perfect.
Okay, so you could. That's one technique you could do, John. Is just use blurry copyrighted stuff and not worry about file size because the images are only like 2K anyway. No, of course you want to balance quality and size and stuff. So certainly you could use some kind of picture fill thing because, you know, each one of the chunks of content, the divs that contain those images or images plus extra content or whatever, you can just drop whatever in there. There's nothing stopping you from dropping, say, a picture element in there and then polyfilling that up so that you get an image that gets picked that's appropriate for the screen size. Nothing stopping that kind of thing. If you're using CSS background images in that slider, then you can use media queries to serve the images that are of appropriate size. And I wonder if you're asking, like, do you want us to throw out size in kilobytes that's acceptable because that would be tough to do. But, you know, I always like the, you know, a megabyte is kind of pushing it on websites kind of thing. And if you absolutely need to get that carousel or slider thing in there, which hopefully you can avoid at all because, you know, generally it shows that engagement kind of sucks on those. And it's mostly just as Brad Frost says, to prevent people from killing each other in meetings. Everybody can be on the homepage. But, you know, maybe can you get them down? Can you get them? Can they be 100K each? Can they be 50K each? That would be sweet, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's tricks, right? Like when you do those big images, like the full width, and you want to overlay text, right? You need that image needs to have some contrast to the text that's over it. You can't just like do a picture of a sky and have white text because like your text will disappear in a cloud. Maybe that's the effect you're going for, but you need contrast, which might mean like that Jeremy Keith style of like stripping out colors, what he did for the Deconstruct site, and he blogged about it. That might be a good technique.
That's clever. I never read that. Is it really like these images can be compressed further if they're kind of
monotone? Duotone? Yeah, like black on black or like grayscale on red or something like that, or grayscale on green. It's like you basically limited the number of kilobytes, basically. Okay. So. That's something you can do. There's, you know, you can always slide the quality setting in your Photoshoppers and that, you know, 70 is probably fine for a big image like that. But then again, it's like, if you're going to do a big image, you want it to look good. Right. So you're in this paradox of like, it's a design challenge. It's like,
right.
Being beautiful, quote unquote, I'm using the biggest quote fingers I own. I've bought some foam quote fingers for that. Being beautiful and fast are kind of at odds. So
sometimes they are. Yep. You know what I thought of when I read this question, I was like, well, okay, it's a slider, right? So not all of them are on screen at one time, right? So why don't you get a little clever with your JavaScript and only load like maybe one and the next one that's able to be traversed to, or load the first one and then lazy load the rest of them, or, you know, just get clever so that the speed is fast, because, you know, it's not just size, you know, like we can talk about just size, but of course it's how fast the page loads, how fast it responds. Those are actually kind of more important subjects of discussion than just what's the complete loaded full weight of the entire page, you know?
Yeah. If you're doing a slider, like the biggest rule of thumb is never load all of them. Like you have to lazy load or JS template, you know, use some templating or something to build the rest of the slides after the DOM's ready. Cause you don't want your user to wait for all these 10 giganto images to load. Cause on a phone, they'll leave your page before that happens. So bounce rate, 10 seconds. You got 10 seconds on a phone. Choose wisely.
That even seems like a long time, but good luck, John. We got our audio here. Will that play?
Is that it? Yeah, we got it. I got it here. I double checked it here. It's from Daryl Snow. Calls in to the Shop Talk hotline and asks, oh, it's loading. Here we go.
Hello, Shop Talk. I'm wholeheartedly jumping on the SVG icons bandwagon, but I'm struggling with a couple of things. I like to size icons with M's or REMs, but SVGs always have to have a viewbox attribute with sizes specified in pixels, and whenever I paste an SVG into my markup and play around with that, it can go wrong. Also, I really like the idea of including an SVG icon sprite after the opening body tag and then including the icons further down the page with a use element. But then I don't seem to have access to the guts of the SVG in case I want to style or animate parts of the icon. Is that the case? What's the best?
These are all excellent questions, Daryl.
Yeah, this is kind of the Chris Coyer specialty here.
Yeah, it is a little bit lately, and you're right on most of it. The view box you should just leave alone, like the prop for the most part, right? Like if you have 100 pixel by 100 pixel, canvas in that you're designing it on in Illustrator, and then the view box is 0, 0, 100, 100. Just leave that alone. That's not saying that's how big the SVG actually has to be rendered. It's just like setting up the playground for the SVG to be rendered on.
So that's like coordinates for inside the SVG. If you were to think about it like a charts and graphs, you're saying this is, you know, origin 0, 0, and it goes out 100 pixels and goes down 400 pixels or something.
Yeah, right? And if you screw with that, it's going to screw with the aspect ratio of what's inside of it and look weird and bad.
So what about the height and width? Because this is something I'm confused about.
Well, then those are just unrelated. Then set your height and width, and then
those are my scalers that scales the image.
Yeah, exactly. And you can't, I don't think you can mess with the aspect ratio there then, you know? Like if you make it like, if you stretch out, if the view box is 0, 0, 100, 100, and then you make the width 100, but you make the width 200, you, like you double it, it'll just be like, too bad. I'm going to render the SVG, the actual element will take up 200 pixels of width, but I'm not going to stretch my guts out. It'll just be blank over there.
So the SVG is just like, I don't have those. I ain't going to do nothing.
Exactly. So if you need to mess with the aspect ratio of it, which you like is like never in SVG, you know, like just leave that alone. But then do your width and sizing either with width and height attributes on the SVG itself or much more likely in your CSS. And then you're right. So you're defining them at the top of the body or whatever. You're deciding to use inline SVG and kind of that templating thing that I've been talking about a little bit. And then you use a use element later, which I think is a nice and cool, clean way to do it. You can then target that SVG and CSS. And for example, say SVG in your CSS, go SVG fill blue or whatever. And the paths and recs and circles and stuff within it will fill blue, which is kind of a feels weird because you're not actually targeting those elements. You're targeting the SVG. So you're like, why does it do that? I don't know. It just does. But you're right that you can't then select a path. You can't from your CSS go, let's say that actual SVG element, like the actual element that you're dropping on the page, you give a class of like Dave. Then in your CSS, you go Dave, fill blue. Well, it'll fill all the shapes blue. You'd think you could go dot Dave space path fill blue.
Like, to select a single path.
Yeah, right? Because that's kind of one of the cool parts of SVG icons is they can be multicolor, right? And you'd you get CSS control. But, maybe I haven't done a good job being as clear about this. You can't – that's a shadow DOM boundary you can't do. And if you look, it just doesn't let you do that. I mean, for whatever reason. You can, though, which is weird. Like if you gave that path name a class of .chris, you could go .chris and do the fill from CSS because it's not crossing a shadow DOM boundary. You know, it's just that's a selector and it's in the DOM and it gets styled that way. But a kind of a combo selector. So that's weird. Like if you have an ice cream cone SVG and you have three of them and you use three times in a row from CSS, you can't really via class names on the SVG have three different versions of the ice cream cone. You just can't. It's kind of a bummer that way. But whatever. I think. So what's that?
Sorry. So if I had like an ice cream cone vector with three scoops of ice cream, right? 1, 2, 3, and I could not go like dot ice cream cone path and get the SVG. But if I said like, if I named each of the balls of ice cream, like top, middle, bottom, I could style it like Neapolitan ice cream.
Totally.
That's kind of what you're saying.
Right. Okay. But then you have another one further down the page and you want to style it vanilla, chocolate, vanilla and use this and do the same exact use situation. You can't really, because that's
okay.
But you know, like what are the chances of that? You know, like occasionally I could see that being cool. You can still do multicolored icons that you control via CSS. You just can't do multiple variations of the same one just by using a class. And and eventually you will be able to, because there's going to be some way to cross the shadow DOM boundary with CSS. It used to be thought of as the cat and hat thing. Now it's looking a little bit more like a pseudo selector, like a colon thing. I forget what it
shadow
is.
Root
shadow root. Yeah, shadow. Something like that. Yeah.
Base.
So you're right, but you know, I still find it very useful because a lot of my icons are just single color anyway, and then you can use it multiple times in the page and color it in different ways and stuff. I don't know. It's still pretty useful, but yeah, that is a little bit of a limitation with the use thing. And it's going to get better over time.
Yeah, cool. Hey, so you have to put it after the body tag still? Is that kind of...
It turns out not to be true, actually. And I guess I need to redo my testing. And Dave's talking about, you know, you do the defs block. Like, I'm just going to define a bunch of SVG shapes in which to use later. I've always said you got to put them at the top of the body because if you don't, there's some browser that screws up. And I thought it was Chrome, and I think I've even written that somewhere. And then somebody tweeted me, or maybe several people have, and they're like, yeah, but you don't do that. I put mine at the bottom of the body, which I I kind of prefer, because I don't, you know, just for the speed of loading.
Loading things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's been a problem in no browsers. So I'm like, well, why did I ever say that? Like, was there a test? Maybe, I can't remember why.
So when I remember you wrote it, it was like Chrome 29, which is dead in the wild.
Could
now.
Be. I maybe. Bet that's it. I bet it was a, you know, because you don't even notice when Chrome updates, right? So maybe it was a problem right. in an older Chrome that has just disappeared from the face of the earth. So I should change my articles on that.
So right now, just to cap Daryl's question, it's you SVG use is pretty sweet, and we can use it today.
Another right? criticism I get is that people don't like, not that I get, like I invented this. I absolutely did not. But I am excited about it and talking about it. Is that you have to have this big chunk of HTML on every single page, and then that means that has to kind of come across the wire every time, and it can bloat your page cache. It's like, why can't we use caching, some kind of actual browser-level caching for this? And the answer is you kind of can if you want to leave IE out. Like, let's say you have a project that for some reason you can ignore IE on. And that way you can use the use element just like we were before, only rather than just referencing it with just a hash, you know, like hashtag Twitter icon, because you've defined it earlier in the document, you can link out to a file. Be like SVG definitions.svg hash Twitter thing. It's kind of like a URL fragment style. And in the future, you'll be able to actually do that with images and CSS background images too. Like, say, background image, you know, mysprites.svg hash Twitter icon, and it will know what you mean. It says, only give me that part of it. That's how fragment identifiers, I think they're called, are going to work.
Yeah.
And that's cool. It's just not as supported yet. And but in the case of use, that does actually work in most browsers, except for IE and even 11. So it's one of those things that, like, oh, it's too bad. And you Iconic, you know, that really nice icon framework that uses a lot of this stuff in smart ways. They just released Iconic Open or Open Iconic or something like that, and it uses that. And I was talking with PJ about it. He's, you know, kind of the man behind it, and they're just kind of advocating using it that way. So with the caching, and I, you know, I talked to him. I'm like, what's the deal with IE? And I think they're toying around with some kind of JS polyfill for it.
I think I looked at that the other day because I heard this awesome talk from Todd Parker of Filament.
Oh,
Group.
Were you at that talk? That looks so good.
I was there. There's some slides. You can find Todd Parker, Filament Group. He gave this awesome talk on SVG. So he mentioned this, and so I started clicking around, and I looked at that JavaScript thing, and what it looks like they're doing is they're like just basically, I think they're like Ajaxing it, and then they're injecting that SVG definition into the.
Oh, heck yeah. That's super clever, right? Because then the Ajax call, where you're like, well, that's not very efficient. We're like, it is still cached, though, or at least you can tell that Ajax call.
Yeah, well, and it's kind of like, you're just fixing browsers that are struggling to update. So I think they call it SVG injector. So
yeah, why not?
Fast caching, dynamic inline SVG DOM injection library.
Hell yeah, that is the way to do it. Good. Yeah. Of course, they came up with it too, and they're gonna work on it for Grunticon too. I think there's some kind of like.
Yeah, this is probably the key to get Grunticon just to work.
Yeah, it really is.
Drop a folder of SVGs. You say Grunticon, and it'll just run through this and be awesome.
And do the PNG one too. So that's pretty sweet. It's a little tougher with SVG use right in the document, because then you got to be a little fancier, dancier, and use classes like, if it's not supported, then you have to put additional markup in there, like a div to display. So, like, I don't know. Usually in the case of inline SVG, I'm like, I don't know, even know if I would go there. If not, but what I would do is do it the Grunticon style, where you just use a div period in the markup, and it will make a background image of SVG. So you don't get some of the inline SVG awesomeness, but you get a lot of the advantages of SVG, like the scaling and the vec, you know.
I was going to call it there, but yeah. Shop Talk listeners, we just talked about SVG for 10 minutes. It might be something you want to check out there.
Yeah, you should indeed. Right. And I got to publish my slides too. I'm jealous that he got to publish his, and I'm like, I got two, but I don't know. Like, all the conferences I'm at, I'm like, not sure how cool that is, you know, when you're like, just watch my talk online or pay $500, you know? I was...
Yeah, pay $1,200 or...
Which, I know it's different than that, but I just try to keep it under my hat a little bit until kind of the season of this talk is over kind of thing.
Sure.
I don't know. No, I don't know what the right thing is to do, so I err.
That makes sense. I'm telling you, that was a good talk. I'm sure your talk's good, too. You can always have more people talking about it.
Oh, yeah,
good.
Of course, because this is literally I'm literally spreading the good word, and I'm like a missionary of SVG. It's mostly not my work. I'm mostly like, this is important and it matters, and I can have a thing for the first time.
It's the next frontier of graphics there, I think.
Thanks to Campaign Monitor for sponsoring Shop Talk Show, the relatively new sponsor on here. We're glad to have them. In one of the last shows, I explained how we put our little subscribe button in our sidebar and how super duper quick it was to do that because of their super cool RSS to email feature on Campaign Monitor. It just sucks down an RSS feed. When it senses there's a new entry, it sends an email that you get to craft up and kind of make nice, and it goes out to all those people. And there's plenty of people that have signed up for it already. People just like, we're not forcing it down anybody's throat. People sign up because they like emails of new content. It's kind of like in this post RSS world. What do you do? I shouldn't say that. I still use RSS, but a lot of people are kind of off of it now, and they're like, I just use Twitter. And I'm sure a lot of people are like, you know what? I'll sign up via email for the blogs I like, because why not? Anyway, that was a whole thing. But Campaign Monitor is also just like it helps you send nice-looking, responsive emails to people, however you want to do that. So it's kind of a hard thing to do. You can't just, design an HTML email and paste it in Gmail and send it. Actually, I think you kind of can, but that's dangerous territory. You don't want to get your Gmail account blocked or anything, which it will if you send out 10,000 emails to people. That's dangerous territory. It's hard to get good deliverability and good looking emails across all the different clients and stuff. It's a hard, sucky problem to solve. And it's like one of those perfect things. Like, why don't you let a web app do it for you? That's what Campaign Monitor does. And they do a hell of a good job doing it. They also, what's interesting about them is do white label. So if you are a agency and you have clients that want to send email, they're like, help us with this. You'd be like, no problem. We basically wrote an app that sends email.
Yeah,
and
I'll
we just
write you an app.
It happens to cost $250 a month or something. And then you just pay Campaign Monitor, whatever it is on the back. You're just a reseller for Campaign Monitor. Except for that you get to design the back end, put your logo up there, makes you look super professional. You know how white labeling works. It's not shady. You're providing your clients a really good service for money that you set up to help them with. And then you become the support for it too. So this is just total legitimate business. But I think it's cool that Campaign Monitor has white labeling. That's one of the things they do. They said for us to check out CampaignMonitor/top 100, which shows it's like an ebook of their top 100 email campaigns of last year, which I think is really cool.
That's cool. If you want to beta test it or what, sign up for the Shop Talk email. I know this sounds like an ad for our email subscriber, but what we do in WordPress is we just post it and it sends to you, and you get a list of links. And when we do the show notes, I don't know if you listen or check out the show notes, but we do some show notes and usually some hot links from the past week or what we talked about. So, it can also be a way for you to publish out your weekly newsletter and stuff like that. So just by using WordPress, something you're comfortable with. So it's pretty cool. Check it out. Subscribe to our thing. Ta-da. Right?
Indeed.
Cash. All right. We good?
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to check out that top 100 here. All right. Next question. Is, oh shoot, I'm totally unprepared. It's an audio, I'll switcheroos these two. Sneer David writes in, since jQuery is so widely used over the internet, and since it tends to be somewhat heavy to deliver to the end user, why don't browsers just include various versions of jQuery with the end user machine loading it as they encounter usage?
Like, why isn't jQuery just bundled in Chrome? And then when it senses that you want to use jQuery, it just delivers it locally, whether you've ever had it cached or not. It's like a perma-cache of jQuery. That is a weird, interesting question. And I'm two minds on it in the 10 seconds I've been thinking about it, that's kind of clever. It really is a very popular library, and that would speed up websites. And of course, browsers are always worried about how to make their web browsers faster. But it also seems like weirdly scary and like not how the web works kind of thing. Like, how do you absolutely guarantee, like, you could call a file jQuery-1 or 2.0.1-JS and then put whatever you want in it. Like, how would you know for sure that that website is asking for that version of jQuery, like, unequivocally, absolutely, that's what's in there? Or maybe they put some extra code at the bottom of it to alter it or something. Would you just match on file name? I mean, how does a browser make the determination that they should serve their file and not the one that they actually linked to on the web?
Yeah, I mean, what's the difference between jQuery and jQuery.fitvids or something? But you'd think, okay, in the instance of Chrome, right, if it detects a ping to the Ajax lib URL, it could just...
Yeah, because people actually don't have control over that. So
yeah, so it could just say, no, yeah, we got it, like, instant.
Right.
We loaded from memory. Mm-hmm. And so that's interesting.
You know, a lot of times people... I think that didn't the where the cookies crumbles on that one is that generally it's not a good idea to just load jQuery by itself anyway, and you should probably bundle it up with all your other libs.
Yeah, and there's probably security stuff too. That was if the browser is loading its own copy. I mean, Google has promised us to not be evil, but what if Google decides, like, every time you click a button, it will get all your account data and just send it to Google? You know, like, maybe they could also do that already, but, like,
they kind of can because, you know, of the, well, you know, just somebody somewhere at Google has the ability to alter the files that are on that CDN. And that's dangerous territory because, you know, then at some point you could write something that does XSS is the point. You know, you could be like, oh, what nice looking cookies you got there. I'll have those.
Or, you know, like, this is again, I'm picking on Google, but, you know, Microsoft, or I doubt Firefox, but, you know, Apple or somebody could just decide, like, hey, you know, maybe since they're there, I'm just going to collect some statistics, you know, about what sites they go to and stuff.
And, you know, that doesn't even have to be in the jQuery. That could be a server log scenario too.
Sure, totally. I think scenario would sort of, like, start. It would give people the heebie-jeebies to not be using the code they intended, you know? And that's kind of part of programming, right, is you need, like, it's sort of like a brittle, it's sort of like balancing a plate on a stick, you know? So if somebody's kind of getting too clever, it could all come crashing down real hard. So that's sort of how I feel about it, yeah?
I think you're right.
Cool, boom! I think we answered that question. Next comes
from AJ. You've mentioned Harvest as a tool for time tracking and invoicing. Are there any other tools you would suggest specifically for expense tracking? Bonus points if it's free. Love the show. Keep up the good work.
All right.
I would go with a credit card.
Expense tracking? That's mine. I do... credit. I have a business bank account, and it is...
Do you really? That's not Paravel. It's like Dave Rupert LLC.
Oh yeah, Dave Rupert LLC bank account, and I swipe everything through that. I mean, and because I'm in the situation, you know, we have like this podcast, or I, you know, do other dumb stuff, you know, open source projects. Yeah. I have to shell out money for.
I just did it, so I'm on board too. And so now I'm applying for a simple.com account. Just like the online bank, right? So I get I can pick any bank I want that I'm actually going to use this time. I've had one of those before, but I don't know. I just didn't use it. Like I like to have one bank, or I don't know. I'm going off on a tangent here, but yeah. But then I'll have a bank account that does expense tracking, essentially, if you are smart enough and make all of your business expenses go through that.
Yeah, and then it's kind of all online. And then what I do from there, and again, this is another sponsor, and I do less accounting. Alan Branch, cool guy over there. Like,
does that suck in from your bank account?
Yeah, so that'll suck in all my bank account, my PayPal, and everything. And then
PayPal too.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. And so I have that all in one kind of thing. And then I go through each month or whatever and categorize all the expenses. Like, that was advertising, because it turns out like whatever my GitHub falls under advertising, I guess. I don't, because like old tax codes don't really modernize or whatever. But and so I kind of file everything into different categories, and then my accountant can also sign on and kind of go look through that. And I'm actually, I hate money. I hate money. I have like a fear of money. So I'm just like going to pay somebody to like go through and even categorize those things and then just call me if there's questions.
Categorizing would be nice. That's the one thing I do manually too. That's a pain in the butt. But yeah. Use tools for this. Yeah, I would definitely not like make this your thing that you're lax on in your life. You know, don't have a markdown file or like a piece of paper on your desktop that's just like, oh, what did I spend this week again? You know, like that's bad news. To actually have, you know, as much real transactions that you can record and look at online and stuff.
And then another thing I do is, this is a pro move, you take a picture of the receipt with your iPhone and whatever, just throw it into Dropbox. I don't think you really need it if it's under like whatever $250 or something, but it's nice to have in case you're like, why did I spend $80 at the Apple store? You know?
Yeah, that's
like
clever. And then because it's no work, right? You just snap the pic and somehow
and it's done.
Yeah, it'd be nice if you could email it to some address that would file it somehow, like by date and geolocation or something, you know? Yeah. So it's equally no work. What it needs to be is no work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I used an app called Billings. This is a pretty cool app. It got to the point, no like slight against it. It was a cool app, but like it helps you track mileage and stuff like that. But it does invoicing too, just like Harvest. But one thing it did, it was like, you know, you had to buy the Mac app and then you had to buy the new versions of each app as they all came out. So I was getting a little bit like, oh, I'm just, you know, like and then I never remembered to use it. That was my big thing too, is I never remembered like, oh, now it's time to use the special bill, you know, my business application. If you're better at that, you know, maybe it's good to get like a very specific application like Billings or something going. That's something to think about.
Indeed. Those are all.
And then, or you could buy a Ruby on Rails book, and the first thing they teach you is how to do an expense tracking app in every single Ruby on Rails book.
I am.
And then you're going to make millions.
Yeah. So. Build your own really hard application. I'm very much looking forward to the day where I got my Simple account done. I have a credit card. It's attached to Simple. My PayPal account is attached to it. I'm using Less Accounting or QuickBooks or something, and I know Alan would kill me if I said that, but it might be the case just because that's what my accountant prefers, whatever. And then when it's just all tied together, oh my God, and I'm actually – my actual personal life isn't attached to every business thing. Oh, what a pain. It's been a pain for like 3 years, and finally I did it. And I did it thanks to LegalZoom, which also is not an ad, but I heard it from ads on NPR shows and stuff, and it was really easy. So whatever. Not an ad. Not an ad.
Yeah. AJ, it costs some money. I spent probably more than I should to get all set up on a business and stuff like that, like $1,000+, but I got like LLC'd and everything. And I know that it's like not everyone has that and stuff like that, but if you can find an accountant who will do that for you, like that's when your life starts taking, like if, for me, it was like the difference of being overwhelmed by my taxes to being just behind, if that makes sense, you know, like I was like freaked out and paralyzed, and now I'm just like, ugh, I gotta do that. So that's where I'm at now. And it's worth the money to like get all that set up. So if you think you're gonna be freelancing for more than a year, so all right, should we go to another sponsor?
All right, everybody, and I'm for another sponsor spot. This one we haven't talked about yet, and I think it's going to be awesome. It's an Environments for Humans. They're doing that an in-person event. You know, they kind of do both. They do the summits, which are online, but this is like a we're going to all go here and hang out with each other in the flesh. It's the CSS DevConf. So literally that's the URL, cssdevconf.com. It'll take you to the 2014 subdomain of that. And it's a cool time for this because there's plenty of time to think about it and get planning for it because you're all going to come, of course, because it's in New Orleans. This is going to be sweet. October 13th through 15th. So what's happening right now, which is cool about this conference, is that a lot of people have already submitted talks to it. And you can go to cssdevconf.com and vote for the ones that you want to see. And what's really cool about that is they don't tell you like who it was. It's just like, this is the topic for the talk, and this is my pitch for it, and I would I'm going to vote for it on like a scale of how interested I am, and then those all get kind of weighed out. And there's a lot of them, so, you know, just to be fair or whatever to everybody, I think they're kind of randomized or whatever. It's like a SurveyMonkey form. But go do that, just, you know, because I think that's cool anyway, even if you're not going to go. Like, what's a cool talk? That way, the people that get chosen for are chosen on the merits of their talk, which is pretty cool. And there's some keynotes already kind of picked out for the conference too, which is cool. Me being one of them, so if you want to hang out with me, come. I'm very much looking forward to it. I already booked my flights. He's on excited. Dan Cederholm's going to be there too, and you know we both play the banjo a bit. We're talking about bringing the banjos down, seeing what happens. So that should be pretty fun. Yeah. Rebecca Murphy, Estelle Weiler, Rachel Neighbors, Jonathan Snooks. Going to be a good old time down in New Orleans. Again, that's October 13th through 15th. You can buy tickets right now if you want to, and there's workshops and stuff. It's going to be in the French Quarter. You got to see the pictures of the hotel. It looks fancy.
Mm. You know how last CSS DevCon, for two CSS DevConfs ago, we had ukulele music, you know? Yeah, yeah. Maybe I need to buy like a jazz trombone.
Yeah. So, that's the kind of the bass.
You could have a sousaphone.
Yeah, I think I'd go tuba if I had to pick.
Get a tuba, and then I'll get a jazz trombone, and I'll look exactly like Commander Riker, and it'll be great. Anyway, let's
move. A sousaphone is a tuba. I'm an idiot.
No, but it's like big and it wraps around you.
Oh, that's the diff.
It's like a tuba with a jacket. All right. Anonymous writes in.
Yeah, we normally don't do anonymous, but you know what the heck. And this one is, I don't know what to say about it. But he says, what do you think of Netflix disabling their developer console in Chrome? Will this become a popular feature in the future? Is it unethical? I didn't even know that they did this, and I went to just straight up Netflix.com, and it doesn't seem to be doing it. And then I launched the player, but my Silverlight plugin was out of date, and I decided to not care enough to update it. So do they really do that? Have you seen that? Have you heard of this?
I have seen articles about this, and this is more, I guess, like, I don't want to get hot drama about it, but yeah, Facebook and Netflix are experimenting with disabling the console, which is basically they like object.defined window.console, and then they're just like, disable. Like, they basically just hack it. They set it
and
to
you
zero.
Not even open it, or is this just the console tab of the dev tools? Can you still
you can open it, but it'll say, hey, nothing works. Like, it'll say, sorry, for security reasons we deactivated the script. And their security reasons are probably,
are they XSSE, or are they like, when you do, like, let's say you like a post on Facebook, of course that's an AJAX request, right? So right. You could write a script that runs, that I don't know, uses the console somehow to like hammer them with extra AJAX requests or something like that.
Yeah, like I could get all my friends to just install a little script or whatever, a little Chrome script that does something.
I mean, you could
and
just
over.
Use a bookmarklet or something. I mean, I don't know. It just seems like, is there actually a security problem, or is it?
It's a thin layer of security. Yeah, I don't really know what the justification or like what they're actually trying to do. Maybe it was like get access to cookies and like reverse engineer them or something.
And there'd be only your own cookies, you know.
Maybe. Let's see, API requests can be made inaccessible from XSS, cross-site scripting. That's really interesting. I am not a fan. I feel like it's a thin layer of security, but it's interesting to see what's going on. I feel like it breaks the whole point of the web, which is like sharing and like, I am not installing any viruses. View source to see that, you know.
Just more concerned about what even thinly it protects.
Right. Like probably like grabbing URLs to videos on different.
Oh, maybe that's what it is.
I mean, maybe that's gotta. That's the only thing I can think of, you know. But media protection or something like that.
Oh, that Netflix's part. Yeah, I don't know why I was focused on Facebook. I didn't realize they were doing it either. Oh well, whatever. I guess we just err on the side. I would err less, you know, like Dave saying this is dumb, and I'm saying I wish I just knew. I wish I could talk to the developer who wrote these lines of code and been a fly on the wall for that meeting, because what were they talking about?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, maybe that's my problem too, is I don't understand enough about these scripting vulnerabilities and stuff like that, that maybe I'm just noob town and getting exploited like a mofo. But
at web apps, you just don't know what's happening behind the scenes. I mean, at CodePen, nobody out there has any idea what we talk about, what we deal with, what's coming through support, what's seemings like a nasty thing today. There's all kinds of stuff like that happens that nobody ever hears about, believe me, you know. So I'm sure that's what's going on here.
Well, all right. Hopefully that we answered that question poorly. Let's move on to the next question.
Chris, Brett.
Writes in. Inline block grid systems. Nickname Nick Gallagher's Griddle. If you go to nicolas.github.io/griddle, won't render correctly in Safari 7. Works fine on Safari 6, Firefox, Chrome, but fails miserably in Safari 7. Any solutions and advice would be greatly appreciated.
I looked at this back in the day. Oh, yes. He has a screen grab. But I saw it too, and it's legit. I was like, oh, that's interesting, really. First of all, I didn't even know Nicholas Gallagher had a grid thing that he did. And he doesn't, actually. I'm sure he'd be annoyed that we're even talking about it at all, because I think he's kind of like, it's SaaS-based, and he's like off the SaaS wagon or something like that. I don't know. He tends to... I don't know.
SaaS
be protective over stuff like this. I'm sure he even regrets even publishing it, especially because now it's like, oh, great. You know, 6 months later, there's a bug and I just don't even want to fix it. So now what do you do with open source, which is like the other classic question in our industry, kind of. If you're Dave, you're a hero and you answer every support request that comes in for Fitvids. Or if you're the rest of us, you're just like, oh, my God, why do I do anything? It is broken. Yeah. And what's that?
Oh, go ahead. Yeah, if you can diagnose it. I think it's subpixel rounding, it is. Probably, right?
It is. Yeah. And it's fixable. And what the way to do it is to use inline blocks in such a way that there's no, you're not like trying to figure out, you know, it's like because the inline blocks are defined with like width equals 17.83298M. It's like an M-based grid system thing. And yeah, it's getting rounded improperly. They're falling down. You can kind of tweak the numbers to get them okay, but then they're off in other browsers. The answer is to do the no space thing. Do the, like, the parent element has font size 0 or whatever, and then bump the font size back up within it. Of course, that has other CSS implications. There just needs to be a better way to handle that. I've seen ones where it's like, use a special at font face that defines the font as 0 space. And there's all kinds of, like, crazy hacky things you can do to this. But, you know, whatever. Or you can just make the divs that contain it actually not have any space in the HTML. That's usually my least favorite one, because I don't like having to enforce like an HTML coding style to make layout work. You know, something about that bothers me.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's an open issue for it now. So if you want to fix it with one of those things, go for it. Submit the pull request.
I think that's the thing, is it also kind of comes down to like, the does it have to render the same in every browser? And my answer is kind of no. I mean, I would probably just shore up the numbers to make it like smaller, and then it works in Safari if that's like a big target browser of yours. But you could also, you know, just say, what's Safari? I don't know.
That's a pretty new Safari. That's the latest Safari.
Yeah, but anyway, I think it's kaboom. Tough. That's probably not worth it. All right, next.
Keegan Lambert writes in, having recently decided to do some freelance web design, I am confident in my pricing. However, when writing up emails to a potential client, giving them an estimate, I feel like there is room for improvement. Wondering how Dave/Paravel approaches this. Do you send some kind of template or something else? So there's that moment where they're like, we need an e-commerce website and we have 30 products and we need to send an email newsletter and we'll probably have a contact page. And, you know, and so you're like, oh, we're happy to help you with that. That sounds like this much money, this many hours. Here's a PDF. How do you do that kind of stuff?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying like we have it figured out. So like whatever, take this with a grain of salt, but maybe this will get you inspired or whatever to head in your own direction. We basically send like a cover letter that just introduces us. Page two is in like kind of a bit about our history or whatever. Page two is broken up into phases, which are very waterfall-y, but we're very like honest about how it kind of all like bleeds together. We're kind of like in these two phases kind of are happening at the same time, but there's like a discovery phase, which is like, we'll get to know your company, diagnose your problems on your website. You know, we kind of like, that's one chunkable. If you think of it like a table element or whatever, it's like the TH is discovery and the TD is all the bullet points we kind of plan to do during that discovery process. The next one would be like Photoshop designs, where we take the learnings from the like discovery process and we kind of start building out templates and stuff like that, like, or kind of building out pages, vibes, and all that. We don't really do like style tiles and stuff. We kind of go from like sketches to Photoshop, which is weird, but that's just our workflow. Phase three is development, like where we're actually coding it. And we kind of say like in verbally and then maybe it's even in the contract or whatever, but it's kind of like once you sign off on something, like a chunk of something, we can go to code with that. Like if you sign off on the header and you're like, yeah, that looks good, let's keep working on X, Y, and Z, then we can kind of start coding out the header. And that, you know, works and it doesn't work. But then phase four is launch and testing and QA, basically. It's just like a round of revisions pre-launch, or maybe if you're beta testing, we'll go to beta and then like rework in all the like fixes from the beta after that. So that's kind of how we do it. We kind of do it in four big chunks. And then we're kind of like, then we have a third page that's kind of says out the timeline, you know, like what we expect, payment delivery, like payment dates we kind of expect. And then because a lot of companies you work with, they're like net 45, we'll pay you in 45 days after you're finished. And that's really bad. So we just kind of like to say, no, we want to be paid like whatever at every phase of the process or something like that. And so in this much of the total project budget. Oh, am I good? Oh, and then okay. We're like,
that's good stuff.
Then we're like, here's an hourly rate for anything beyond this scope. You know, like if you want HTML emails and anything like that, that's basically our hourly rate, like, to get that done. And, you know, it's just sort of, for us, it's kind of like we can do a lot of things, but the things we want to do are in the proposal, you know, or in the scaffold, in that table of doings. And then the third page is just kind of like, if this stuff is important to you, we can do it. And we're this much an hour, because we don't want to like incorporate it in the project and then spend 6 weeks doing an email, you know, when that's actually not the stuff we like to do. So hopefully that answers that question.
I'm sure it's appreciated too by your client. You know, sometimes it feels like, I don't know, I make the rules around here, but I'm sure clients are like, hey, thank you for helping me walk me through this and set up proper like, expectations.
I mean, you know how you on CSS Tricks and CodePen, you have the like license, you know, like the what is it? Licensing or terms of service for dummies, basically. Is that what it is? Like just the plain English terms of service. We try to keep our milestones and even what we're building. We try to keep it very plain English. We don't like get super technical and stuff like that. So, but you know, but that's just us being a 3-man shop. So if you're a mega agency, have 20 people, and you have somebody who writes proposals, then maybe you can do something totally different and better. you know. We are involved in one proposal where they're like, send us a binder and a CD-ROM with samples of your work and stuff like that. And we were just like, cool, we're not doing that one. Because we don't do that. So anyhow, sound good? Alex Short writes in, question for Chris. See. Going back to something raised in episode 103 about getting server-side variables into JavaScript. I think the example is username, maybe. Anyway, I wanted to just find the most natural way of doing this. I find myself echoing arrays or data into JavaScript variables so my JavaScript can do stuff with this data. My natural feeling toward it is, well, unnatural and almost hacky. Chris, you have said you turn server-side data into a big JSON object that and that tinged the light bulb in a way. Is that the most pure way of putting server-side data into JavaScript? So he's kind of asking, like, he's like echoed variables into JavaScript. So maybe as a script tag he writes out, and then he has like, you know, var element or var user equals PHP open bracket.
That's exactly what's going on. So let's say, you know, you have a page and you can't put everything in external script, because an external script is cached and whatever. That's not the place to put page-specific JavaScript variables. Let's say you have a web app and you need to know their username. You might need to know that in JavaScript. Perfectly reasonable that you would need to know that in JavaScript, but you can't put that in an external script. It's got to be defined on that page somehow. So, Alex, you're right. That's one way to do it. It would just be to have a script tag right on the page that, like Dave said, has some PHP echo tags or whatever, and it just barfs out that value right inside. It's like a, you know, unholy matrimony of back-end code and front-end code. Yeah. But that's how it works. And he's saying, go ahead.
I mean, that's something you can do. It sounds to me like, yeah, that unholy matrimony, right?
Right. It kind of makes the page uncacheable. You can't use front-end HTML.
And at that point, you've got scripting languages inside your scripting languages, which is kind of yo-dog, right?
Yeah, but it's just, what do you do? You got to do something. So I would say you probably can't do the page cache thing, maybe you can do some kind of, you know, database caching. There's other caching you can use. I'm not all totally up to date on that, but it's not that big of a deal. Just make sure you don't cache the entire page and serve it to everybody. Otherwise, if people are getting the wrong username in their JavaScript, who knows what kind of chaos you can cause for that. And Alex is saying, well, okay, can you just output, instead of just doing var this equals this, var this equals, like giving a bunch of globals, which could be a problem anyway, you could just output like one big JSON object and then use that in your JavaScript too. That's fine. You could even do an AJAX request to the server for all those things that you need, which would be okay. The way that we've been doing is getting away from an inline script tag on the page. And the reason for that is that, you know, have you ever heard of the content security policy? It's like,
yeah, cores.
Well,
cross origin.
Cores is cross origin, but content security policy is a little bit different. They might be in the same family, but it's kind of like it's like a little manifest that describes what is allowed to run and what isn't, kind of thing. It's like a little bit fancy. It's a little bit like iframe sandboxing, but like for your entire website. We're trying to get closer to that at CodePen, and I think we are using it in some places, but you want to kind of use it sideways. It's really pretty cool. It's like a really good security thing that you can do for your sites. And one of the things that it doesn't allow is inline scripts. You just can't do script and then put script in it to be executed on that page. That's not okay in the world of content security policy. So we just try to work around it. And one of the things that we do that, which is I tried to explain in one episode, but I'm sure it was a little abstract, was to put like a hidden input at the bottom of the page where the value of that input is stuff. I mean, it could be a div or anything. I don't even know why it's an input exactly. And then we grab the value of that and turn it into some, you know, like an object full of values that we can then use on the page. So it's just kind of a way around that, I guess. And one of the first scripts that runs is like, find that, turn it into the data that we need so other scripts can rely on it.
Hmm.
It's the way it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the idea that if your JavaScript needs a user object, it just requests a user object and maybe uses a parameter to get that or something. Yeah. But maybe that's not super safe.
The Ajax thing I just thought of. Why don't we do that? It's kind of clever. Just ask the server, like, hey, server, what am I, Captain JavaScript, what am I might need on this page? Give it to me, and now it is available.
Yeah, but then that might be performance.
Yeah, it's an extra request. You know? Yeah.
But, all right, cool. I hope we answered your question. If anyone has blog posts or whatever about that, like, whatever, post them in the comments. Yeah. That's what they're there for. Matthew L. writes in, I'm curious how you manage passwords when working with clients. Do you have a system for keeping client passwords on file? Example, protected Excel document or one password. How do you securely send passwords to clients? Chris, you got anything?
I don't. It's tough. I think I worked with somebody recently that needed some of my server information. And I'm, you know, as I should, like, we all should be a little gun-shy about how we provide something of such delicate value. Like, do you just email it to them? Well, that seems weird, because you could maybe delete your email, but what are they going to do? Are they going to delete their email on their side now that your security is only as tight as theirs is, which that sucks. IMing is sometimes okay, because then it's end-to-end encrypted on the way, so that's a decent-ish way, which seems funny. Is it, for some reason, it feels a little less secure to IM somebody something, but I think it's actually a bit more secure. You can, you know, if you trust your Dropbox, you can make a file in Dropbox and share the folder with them and have them grab it out of there and then just delete that folder, maybe. You could set up a WooFoo form that's SSL and have them fill out the form with that information in it, and they'd have to trust you. That would have to be likewise trust situation, but at least that's a way that you can get it SSL to each other. I don't know.
I'll share this. So, we use 1Password. So, I mean, how do we get them from the clients? That's tough. I mean, you might just be email, or maybe we'll change it. Or what's most likely is, like, if we're hosting a client, we set that up for them and we have their credentials or whatever, and then. So, but we, between each other and, like, keeping things up to date or whatever, we have started using 1Password's multi-vault feature.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if you knew that.
We're totally using this at CodePen, because I have mine and then we have CodePen stuff, and there are 2 different vaults.
And so that's really handy, because, I mean, what was going on was Trent would forget the password to the server, you know, whenever we get like a email at midnight from Media Temple, like, security, you need to update your passwords or whatever. He would just be like, okay, I'll just go update it, and then not tell me about it. And so then when I tried to log in, I would click forget password, and then we'd get a new password, and we weren't keeping track of it. So we started this, like, multi-vault in 1Password, which is basically like you open up 1Password and just, like, say new vault, I think it is. And then, like, you can just start. I think you can even copy over, like, you can export your vault and then import it into the next one or whatever. So it's pretty smooth. For me, there's not a better way to do it, really.
That's secure as hell, because 1Password is pretty darn good at that.
Yeah, and it's like a super cached, you know, file on the, you know, on your server, or like on your Dropbox or whatever you're sharing. So, and it's just super encrypted, and then you send
it is
that
like
over.
Even if Dropbox were to get broken into, all they get is your 1Password file, and those are encrypted. So yes, if they were to break into that, which I guess is possible, but I think it would be very difficult. I mean, they would need to just straight up crack your 1Password, which I've never heard, like, of. I mean, I guess it's possible.
Right. I mean, I think it's just a lot of action. I'm not saying it's unhackable or anything, but that for us, like, to share passwords, that's the best thing. For clients getting passwords, I mean, gosh, I don't know that we've super locked that down in a really efficient way, but
I've seen it. I mean, I've seen even a Google Doc one, because Google Doc, I think, is SSL everywhere. Somebody just set up like a spreadsheet, like, and then they embedded it on their page, and their page just said, need to send us something securely, you know, just drop it in this text area kind of thing. And then you'll see the lock in your browser and you can kind of know that it'll get to them securely. And you got to trust them on the other side, but at least it's a little better than email.
Right.
That's all.
Yeah. Obviously, like, those big companies have a need for that. So they probably have it figured out. So anyway. All right. Cool. That was good. Next, Pablo Dominguez.
Yeah. Last question here. Go ahead.
Oh, how old is enough to be a web designer? I'm in my 40s. And to be honest, agencies and people are looking for 20s. Is the web design world a place for only youngsters?
That's sad.
Sorry, Pablo.
What makes it makes you
feeling that way?
Yeah, right. Where does that feeling come from? I mean, is it a feeling, or did you actually get some ageism coming your way? And that would suck. I'm sorry.
So some of my best friends are 40s. That's the classic thing. Right? Some of my best friends are in their 40s. But what's happening? I'm sure there's ageism, right? But for me, it's almost like price is that's like the motivator, right? Like, somebody in their 40s is probably like has kids and has a mortgage and stuff like that, and so their like necessary salary is maybe older than a 20-something year old kid who like lives with 18 of his buddies and they only eat cereal and drink Natty Light, you know. That's a very terrible beer here in America. The thing, I guess, is like, what, you know, for some companies, it's probably cheaper like to hire a bunch of 20 somethings, right? Is that
could be, and they're, you know, and they're not married and enthusiastic and whatever, you know, like that's, and I know that's some ageism. I'm being ageist right there, but yeah, but they're, you know, so some of that stuff pans out sometimes.
Yeah. It seems to me, and this is my like, it's totally skewed opinion, is that like startups and stuff like that, they just want to squeeze out every ounce of people's youth. All your like go get them attitude, they just want to be like, give it to us, give us all your treasures, like all your energy. So in some sense, I think it exists. I don't think it's right, and I think there are agencies out there that will hire people who are responsible, and you know, that's a value. I assume if you're in your 40s and you made it to your 40s, you're responsible. But yeah, but you know, are you new? Are you very green in the field? You know, maybe the expectation has to be adjusted. Maybe you can't jump in at, you know, your old salary. Maybe you have to take a junior level position and a junior salary to get in. But I don't think there's a cap. But at the same time, most of the people in their 40s that I know start moving into managerial kind of, either they're running shops or they're kind of getting more into the business end, like meetings, and, you know, that sort of proposals and RFPs and all that. But I don't know. Chris, you got any insight?
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, I don't know. Unfortunately, I haven't had to go through this myself, or fortunately, I should say. There is a thing there, you know, like if you apply for a job and they say, well, I'm sorry, no, you can't have a job. Is it, you know, it's one thing to be like, it must be my age, you know, so right. Like, is it, you know, or not? You know, like if they said it's your age, well, that's bad. But I wouldn't just go around assuming that any time you get a no, somebody's being ageist against you,
yeah,
or whatever.
That's and that kind of goes for anything, really. You know,
get good. So maybe I'm optimistic, but people are hiring like crazy. As far as I know, this is an excellent market for the skilled individual. And I think if you're good, you're going to get hired. So get good.
We even had somebody put on their thing that, or email us and was like, we're looking to hire Shopomaniacs.
Yeah.
Like,
we can talk about
there's
that.
Jobs. Put Shop Talk Show on your resume. That's all I'm saying.
Clearly. And Pablo, you listen to Shop Talk Show. Of course you're good.
Yeah. You're like already. You're, you know. Just build a website. you've got that figured out.
Yeah. So. And, you know, even if you're new, it means that you care. It means that, you know, like we weren't trying to pat ourselves on our back a little bit, even though we did just win the Best Podcast of the Year award. But it does mean that you care a little bit. It means you care enough to listen to a podcast about web design, and I do think that counts for something.
I think that's points. Like, same with like people who go to meetups. It's like you want to spend your free time learning more about your craft. You know, that's awesome. Those would be like the first people I'd look to hire, you know, people at meetups and stuff like that. So maybe it's, you know, that old classic networking, but don't be the guy at the networking meetup who says like, "Hi, I'm networking." You know, don't be that guy. Be the person who like just shows up and is very like, "I'm just here to learn," and, you know, meeting people's awesome, and, you know, that helps too.
Indeed.
So, all right. Well, Pablo, I hope we answered your question. Chris, we are out of questions.
We sure
are.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. It's another rapid fire. There might be a few more around here once in a while. It's summer, so we get a little travel-y, but these are fun, right?
Yep, travelitis. And if you're like, "Man, I wish they'd do another show, just picture me at my stepbrother's wedding." So there you go. Thanks everyone for listening, and of course you guys are the best audience in the whole wide world. Thanks everyone, thanks to our sponsors, and thanks to everyone who follows us on Twitter. Follow us if you're not following us, and thanks for everything. You guys are great. Be sure to vote us up, rate us up in the podcatcher of your choice. We actually went through and read a few recently around the Net Awards, and man, you guys are funny. So we really appreciate it.
There was some very good ones in there. Appreciate it.
Yeah, and so you guys are great. And Chris, you got anything else?
ShopTalkShow.com.